Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today it's Chris Rennick on Bread for All.
Okay, well, thank you for coming out on this glorious day. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk for about 40 minutes and then leave about 20 minutes for questions. I always quite enjoy questions, particularly on this subject. I don't propose to give you the digested read of my book. I want those of you who haven't bought it yet to do so. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to address two questions which are central to the book that I wrote. And that question is how it is that we came to get the welfare state that we did in this country in the 1940s, and what our understanding of that history means for how we think about the welfare state right now. And thinking about the welfare state right now is really central to understanding why it was that I decided that I wanted to write a book on this subject. I started writing this book about 4 years ago. Now, quite a lot has changed in British politics since then, so it changes the way we think about lots of things. But it was the case when I started writing the book, and the reason that I wanted to write it was thinking about some of the discussions that we were having in this country that were focused particularly on the idea of austerity as a way of thinking about the nation's finances and what it is that we should think about when it comes to what we kind of broadly call the welfare state. Now, whatever you think about what's happened in this country over the last, particularly 2 years, but then 10 years, I suppose, is the slightly longer time frame. It's worth thinking that austerity has been a key part of what goes on. And according to most of the polling that's done, austerity is still a popular way to think about welfare and about the nation's finances more generally. And so we really need to think about, well, how is it that austerity ended up being the so central to our discussions about finances in this country? Now, obviously, austerity means cuts, and cuts were made in response to the financial crisis of just over 10 years ago. And cuts can be made for lots of different reasons. My talk is not, and my book is not, about cuts and the logic there of them. What I'm interested in is the wider kind of ideas and the language that we use to talk about things like austerity and why it is that we think that it's important. And so what I was interested in the past 10 years were some of the language and the ideas that seem to be a key part of political discussion. So some of the things, just to remind you, if you need reminding, of the things that I'm talking about. We think about this headline. This is David Cameron and George Osborne's public pronouncements that where they depicted in a famous Conservative Party conference speech the idea of people sleeping off a life on benefits whilst other people who had jobs walked past their house where the curtains were drawn. We could also point to this language of strivers and skivers. That was kind of gone out of fashion in the past 2 years, but was a central way of thinking about what welfare was and the people who were recipients of it. And the message, really, I suppose, to cut things short, was the idea that the government is for the strivers. And if we want to understand who the strivers are and who the skivers are, well, strivers are people who are not in receipt of benefits. But there are a range of policies that were brought in, it's sort of, you know, below these kind of headline grabbing things. We think about the benefit cap, which was putting a financial ceiling on the total amount of money that any particular family could receive in state benefits. In many ways, I always felt that was a kind of headline grabbing move and not necessarily a kind of deep ideological shaping of these things. I think probably the much more profoundly transformative project that's been implemented is universal credit. For those of you who don't know what that is, it's the move towards rolling a number of benefit payments into a single payment for families in particular. And it's constructed, regardless of what you think about the idea, it is constructed to deal with what are very well-known disincentives in our welfare system, which are the marginal tax rates that apply when someone comes off of benefits and goes into work. They end up paying a really high marginal rate of tax. And so the idea is, wouldn't it be better if we could have a system that rewards work, that makes sure that work always pays? it's a problematic idea for lots of different reasons, not least because it seems that the IT infrastructure doesn't really allow us to make it work. But the idea itself is you know, it's broader and beyond computer systems. It's about a way of thinking about how unemployment benefits and other benefits should work. Okay, so that's kind of the picture. That's the kind of scene of how it was that I came to the subject, and really the reason that I came to the subject and thought that it would be interesting was that as a historian, we have heard this language before. And we have tried these policies before, and the time that we did that was right back at the beginning of the 19th century. Just here is a depiction from the early 20th century as the better quality picture that I could find here. And the reason that we've heard this before is that we used to have a system in this country called the Poor Law. This is in effect the pre-welfare state is what we would probably describe it as. And what I argue in my book is that this kind of talk of strivers versus skivers and this kind of stuff was in many ways the first great reforming and modernising project in the history of the welfare state that we have. It's something that we tried some time ago at the beginning of the 19th century. And I just want to kind of explain to you why it is that I see it things that way and what the consequences are. So Britain had what we would call the welfare state before the 19th century. It's called the Poor Law. It was about 300 years old by that point in time. The law is that we think of it as modern form, dates back to Elizabeth I, and it was a law that made Britain stand out and unique in Europe and probably the world. And the reason that it made Britain stand out was the Poor Law guaranteed anyone who was destitute help. Other countries in Europe cannot say that they had systems of social support, but there was not a legal guarantee of help for people who were destitute, which is what we have in this country. And understanding that and appreciating that is an important point to think about when it think about the evolution of what we call the welfare state. Now, at the beginning of the 19th century, kind of think of Britain as an industrialising place. We think about a growing economy and all the things that go with it. There became a lot of talk about the Poor Law being something that was being abused, that essentially people were on the make, that this guarantee of help for the destitute was encouraging people to go looking for handouts. And economists were particularly keen on this argument, and they were able to, through various kind of campaigns and through the election of a Whig government in the 1830s, were able to institute a massive and significant overhaul and change of the Poor Law in this country, introducing a new set of poor laws. Now, what were these new poor laws? Well, anyone who's read the novels of Charles Dickens will be aware of the kind of things that we're talking about here. We're talking about the workhouse as being central to the operation of state help, government help, financial aid for people who are in trouble. Workhouses are hundreds of years old, but the new Poor Law said that anyone who wanted help had to go to a workhouse to get it. Now, the conditions in the workhouse, as you'll know, were absolutely appalling. The idea was that it was a disincentive, that conditions were so bad that only those who were truly desperately and really needed help would walk through the doors in order to try and claim help. And that help was, the level of help that people could be expected to receive was guided by something called the principle of less eligibility. What was that principle? Well, it was the idea that the help that someone could receive in hard times should not be more in financial terms than the amount of money they could earn from the lowest paying job in the economy in the outside the walls of the workhouse. So these are the kinds of things that made me think about some of the arguments that we were having in the last decade or so. And what I do in the book is try to chart the development and the movement from the reform of the poor laws around the workhouse and the principle of a less eligibility in the 1830s to a situation only a century later, which is not that long a time, after the Second World War, when we get the advent of what we call the welfare state, which is constituted in terms of a comprehensive social security system based around the national insurance system, a national health service, a mass house building programme, and a variety of other reforms, including raising the school leaving age to 15 and then 16 about 20 years later, based around the system of grammar schools and secondary moderns and technical schools. What I want to try to do in the book is really explain how did that happen, but why did it happen? How in a century did we move to two worlds that are so completely different in lots of different ways? So if we're going to try and answer that question, hopefully you can see this here. This man, William Beveridge, is central. I mean, if you can't see it, you're just going to have to trust me that that is a picture of William Beveridge. Bear with me. I hate to say that this would have worked better if it was raining, but... This is William Beveridge. This is him pictured from a newspaper. I think it may possibly be The Times, just after the publication of his report in late 1942. So Beveridge, by the late 1942, he had been a famous public figure for almost 50 years. We think of him now as being primarily famous for the Beveridge Report, but he had been a prominent public figure. He'd been involved with the Liberal governments at the beginning of the 20th century. He had been the key architect of labour exchanges, which I guess are the things that we call now job centres, which were instituted before the First World War. And he was probably the world's leading expert on unemployment. That was what he was known for at the beginning of the 20th century. And so during the war, primarily because they wanted to keep him out of harm's way and they didn't want him involved in the war effort, the government had asked him to conduct an inquiry into the social services in the country and to make recommendations as to what could be done after the war, because post-war planning was something that, in response to the First World War, the government had decided there was something they needed to think about and do something about early on. So it was thinking had started quite early. And his recommendations, published in his report, formed the spine of what happens after the Second World War under the Labour government. His main recommendation is a system of compulsory national insurance, which everybody would be enrolled into, and there will be three sources of contribution: from employees, employers, and from the state. And there will be flat rate contributions, and in return, people would get flat rate benefits. That's the spine of the report that he makes. Now, what I argue in the book is that this is incredibly important, but the welfare state was not created in a kind of big bang moment in the 1940s, and we can't really understand it just by looking at William Beveridge, no matter how important that report was as a trigger to what happened. And the reason that I argue that is that there are a range of other figures who we need to think of as being important. Chief among them is this chap here, who many of you probably won't be able to see, and that's John Maynard Keynes, the economist, who is also a leading public figure at this point in time. So why do I say that? Well, Beveridge's report, published in 1942, is without doubt one of the most boring documents that's ever been written. I cannot stress enough that you should not embark upon reading. Unless insurance policies are your thing, it really isn't something to spend reading on a sunny day. It's incredibly dry. It's incredibly technical. It's about mortality rates and employment rates and things like that. And the reason for that is that Britain had, in 1942, a system of national insurance. Beveridge did not invent national insurance. National insurance was something that was implemented before the First World War by a Liberal government. Those schemes, though, were only available to particular professions or occupations, and over the course of 30 to 40 years, the number of people who were allowed to enrol in those schemes got wider and wider and wider. And what Beveridge basically does in his report is figure out a way, especially financially, that everybody could be enrolled into this scheme, to make it a universal thing rather than something that people in particular occupations could do. So in that sense, his report is not particularly controversial. It's ideas and systems and things that people were quite familiar with, and it was really a nuts and bolts way of thinking about how to roll it out to everybody after the Second World War. But Beveridge's report was controversial. It was controversial in a number of different ways. And so why was that? Well, it was what Beveridge called in his report his three assumptions And never has a word been so liberally used than this word assumption by Beveridge in his report. And these things he described as assumptions because he said that what he was describing were things that would just simply have to be matters of fact, things that simply happened in Britain after the Second World War, in order for national insurance as a system to work. And these things were incredibly controversial, not just because they were costly, but because they changed the way that we thought about government and what government should be doing in our lives and in society. So what were these assumptions? Well, one was child benefit, what we would call child benefit. It was well known that large families were, or the more children people had, the poorer they had, for obvious reasons. And so Beveridge said, there's no point in arguing about whether we should have this thing called family allowances. We'll just assume that we do in order to proceed with what I want to argue. I mean, so far, so good. The second assumption was a national health service paid for out of general taxation. That's quite expensive and a really significant claim to make, but Beveridge makes the claim and says that we have to have a national health service because things like sickness are a cause of unemployment, and that therefore we should have this service in place for everybody to access it so that the sickness is not something that puts the pressure on the public purse. Well, what was the third assumption? Well, Beveridge's third assumption was that the government would run the economy in such a way that there would always be full employment. As somebody who reviewed my book put it in a quite succinct way, it's like saying that you've got a fantastic traffic policy, it's simply that you need to solve global warming first. It is a really massive assumption. And so what Beveridge is arguing is that unemployment has to be kept below a certain level, and the level was 8%, which is quite high. I mean, that's 3 to 4% higher than we have at the moment. Unemployment needs to be at about 8%, except in extreme circumstances, in order to keep the costs of a system down. So unemployment could run over 8%. I mean, we're not far from the Great Depression at this point in time. It's also worth remembering that he's writing in the context of a war where a government has assumed full economic planning in order to try and beat Germany. So the idea that you might be able to do something similar was not completely out there. The government was doing something for a particular reason. And that's where John Maynard Keynes comes in. Now, John Maynard Keynes is the most famous and important economist of the 20th century. He was at that point in time running Britain's war economy. And he obviously played an important role immediately after in reconstructing the world economy. And he was famous for a number of reasons. Again, he's someone who'd been famous for a while. But what he argued was that he, in a famous series of debates in the 30s, had argued that it was contracting demand was the cause of the problems in the Depression, and that governments should be prepared to spend their way out of trouble. Now, aside from the kind of technicalities about what that meant in terms of the policies that governments should be pursuing, Keynes's general philosophy as an economist was that we are not at the mercy of forces beyond our control. Now, Keynes was a liberal. This is something that I'm going to come on to. He's not a socialist. He doesn't believe in full-scale economic planning. But what he does believe in is that you can act in decisive ways in an economy in order to bring about things like low unemployment, if you choose to, if you want to, and that there are definite things that that governments can do. Now, what I try to do is make sense of the kind of these alliance of these people and these ideas in the middle of the 20th century, both in the context of the 1940s, but I guess in looking to kind of depict it more generally as thinking about how does these events in the 1940s, how do these represent the culmination of a century-long debate about that initial attempt to reform the poor laws in the 1830s. I have three arguments that I make about that process, that century-long process that goes from workhouses, from somewhere not far down the road from here, from the Andover, which was one of the greatest scandals, really, of the mid-19th century, the Andover workhouse scandal, when a Times journalist managed to get themselves into the workhouse in Andover, and what they found were men who were being given putrid bones to ground up to make fertiliser, which is what they were supposed to do in order to receive poor law help, but they were so hungry they were eating and gnawing away at the putrid bones. How do we go from that world to this world of Beveridge and Keynes, of a national health service, of national insurance, of universal secondary education up until the age of 15 with the aim of moving it along further? How did that happen? Why did that happen? And what should we understand that process as being about? So I have three arguments. So the first is that when we think about the welfare state in its 1940s incarnation, there's a certain amount of socialist nostalgia that goes with it. We can think about people like Ken Loach and the kind of spirit of 45 and these kinds of things. I argue that that's wrong, and I argue it's wrong for a number of reasons, one of which is that the welfare state was not meant to be a challenge to capitalism and to liberal democracy and liberal capitalist institutions. It was supposed to make them work better. We had a century of seeing the fallout from these original reforming efforts, and we understood what those problems were, and the question was posed, well, you know, industrial capitalism is something that produces wealth. I mean, there's no denying that. You know, how is it that we can make that system work better given the problems that we've identified with it? And so if we think back to the beginning of the 19th century, the philosophy behind the poor law reformers was the kind of philosophy of the capitalism of the Enlightenment. People like Adam Smith and his invisible hand. The idea if we leave an economic system to run itself, then wealth will be created and then it will be allocated efficiently and fairly as a result. Now, by the end of the 19th century, it's quite clear to everybody that that isn't something that's happening and that this was bad for individuals, people who found themselves falling on bad times. But it's also bad for the whole of society, not just individuals. So if we think about the key problem that I guess shapes our perception of a lot of these things, think about the problem of unemployment, which is a problem that we've always struggled and grappled with. I mean, the Great Depression is the era that looms large in the 1940s, those kinds of that period where unemployment got above 20%, up to kind of 30% in some regions, is the immediate memory. But there's a much longer history. One, if you think about the Lancashire cotton famines of the 1860s, when during the American Civil War, there was the North blockaded the South and no cotton could get out. And the consequence of that was that people who weave that cotton in Lancashire had nothing to work with and were out of work. And it was quite clear to everybody involved that none of those people who were out of work in Lancashire in the 1860s could be blamed for being out of work. Britain is part of a global economy by that point in time, and that problems that happen a really long way away have real consequences right in front of us that we can't blame any particular individual for. And those individuals could do little to support themselves, but there were nevertheless costs associated with helping those people. But what was also clear by the late 19th century was that actually for those people who had jobs, life could be just as tough. There were a number of large-scale poverty surveys in the late 19th and early 20th century. There was probably the most famous by Charles Booth in London, but where I live and work in York, Seaborne Rowntree, of the Rowntree family, manufacturers of fruit pastels. He went door-to-door in York in order to try and find out about people's budgets, about how they lived, how they worked, to try and understand more about their lives. And particularly he's interested and motivated by the idea of, well, who are these people who work for me? 4,000 people in New York worked for Rowntree's at that point in time. And what Rowntree discovers is that even people earning seemingly decent wages struggle to make ends meet. And that seems a challenge to the idea that, you know, work is the way out of poverty, to use a more modern phrase. And what Rowntree described, and something I talk about in the book, is the poverty cycle. What Rowntree described was a kind of ordinary working class life at the beginning of the 20th century, where ordinary events, things like the birth of a child or falling ill or a relative coming to live with you because they were elderly, put stresses and strains on family budgets that make people poor. Those events kind of are over and end, and those people are no longer poor. But then something else happens that drags them down. So the idea that the poor are not a kind of homogenous group, that everybody suffers stresses and strains that can make them poor at any point in time. And the argument here, and it's one that we, you know, we continue to have, is the idea of what is it that we do when markets, as it were, seem to fail? What is it we do when people on decent wages can't afford a house? That's not a modern phenomenon. That's something that's been argued about at the beginning of the 20th century. What do we do when people on decent wages can't access a doctor, for example, as was the case at the beginning of the 20th century? And so the welfare state, as it was created, was an effort to answer that question. How do we do what the market is not doing for people? Now, my second argument, which is related to that, is that it's important for us to appreciate and to think about the fact that the welfare state was a modernising project. It was something that was created and done with the intent of modernising the country. We can think in kind of sentimental terms, I think, about the welfare state a lot of the time. But actually, when we think about it in this broader sense and think about the wide variety of institutions that it involves, we can see that actually it's an attempt to try and kickstart things that are not happening otherwise. And that we need to understand what the welfare state is about. We need to think about Britain's long-running angst about its place in the world. How is it that it's doing in comparison to other countries? How is it that it's doing in comparison to what we might think of as competitor countries? And what is it that we can do to improve our position in relationship to those countries? And by the end of the late 19th century, Britain is worrying after a kind of early burst of success with the Industrial Revolution and the kind of the benefits of capitalism and the creation of wealth, that it's losing ground. And it looked like it was being overtaken by other countries. And the country, I mean, Britain's always worried about a particular other country at any point in time in its history. The late 19th century, the country that Britain is worried about is Germany. A recently unified Germany, which has a hugely impressive education system, some of the best universities in the world. It's got world-leading companies in particularly growing industries like chemical engineering, all these big companies like Bayer and such like. They're all created in the late 19th century and seem to be streets ahead of what's going on in Britain. And it also has a welfare system of its own, and including sickness insurance. And so what Britain is worried about by this point is what can we do in order to catch up with other countries that seem to be moving ahead. And this is something that seems to be particularly apparent if we think about what are the key events that really drive this way of thinking. The key event is the Second Boer War at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century. So Britain wants to reclaim one of these provinces and republics in South Africa. And it sends around 400,000 troops over the course of 3 years to fight what seemed to be a kind of ramshackle guerrilla, sort of group of guerrilla fighters. And it seems particularly worrying that it takes 3 years for 400,000 British soldiers to beat a ramshackle group of guerrilla fighters. This creates a large amount of soul-searching in the country. And that soul-searching is kind of ratcheted up when stories start to emerge towards the end of the war, but more particularly afterwards, that actually lots of people tried to enrol in the army during the Boer War, but around 30% of men who tried to enlist were rejected as being physically incapable of fighting. People start to ask questions about how is it in a country like Britain that is seemingly as wealthy as Britain, 30% of people who try to sign up for the army are rejected as not meeting the basic physical standards. And so health is a subject that really arrives on the scene in Britain after the Boer War, which ends in 1902. We get the first health insurance schemes at the end of that decade, and, you know, less than 10 years after the Boer War. But education is also something that starts to spend more money on by the end of that decade. The idea is that, you know, what effectively happens is we increase the school leaving age step by step. The idea that we have to educate and ensure that young children are in better health in order to eliminate a number of these kinds of problems from happening. And this is all about making Britain kind of fit for the challenges of the modern world. What those challenges are change at different points in time, but that is a key spur behind kind of making the state stronger. Now, my third argument, which is related to this, I think, is that the welfare state, as it was created in this country, was essentially a liberal enterprise. And this to me, is a really key thing. Now, Labour, of course, presides over the creation of the welfare state in a formal sense after the Second World War. And Labour has an incredibly important part to play in this story. I would suggest that the National Health Service is something that we wouldn't have got in the form that we have it if it wasn't for the Labour government. Other parties would have done things differently, and that for that reason we can't separate out the Labour Party from that part of the story. But all of these other institutions have a much, much longer history behind them that go back almost 200 years. And that process involves people from almost every political persuasion leaving a fingerprint on the final product. And this is a really important point, I think. Liberal governments were probably the key players, but Conservative governments had parts to play too. And what I argue is that really it's debates within liberalism, both with a small L and a capital L, that are important to think about in that process. Because liberalism goes from being the philosophy of welfare reform in its 1830s form, it's the principle of less eligibility in the free market, to, by the First World War, having a liberal government and people like Lloyd George and Winston Churchill, who was at that point in time a member of the liberal government, creating labour exchanges, national insurance, health insurance, in order to target all of these problems that I mentioned. And so it's liberal governments that create the first national pension scheme. It's a Liberal government that rolls out labour exchanges and creates national insurance and health insurance. And it's Neville Chamberlain, a Tory unionist, who reforms those pensions to make them more like the ones that we recognise today. And it's also a Conservative government or Conservative-led government that are central to the massive boom in suburban house building in the interwar period, which is also a key part of understanding what governments do to improve the lot and the welfare of their citizens. And so in this sense, it's important to remember that both William Beveridge and John Maynard Keynes are fully paid up members of the Liberal Party. They are individuals who did not join the Labour Party. They stuck with the Liberals throughout this period. Beveridge, in fact, was a member of Parliament for the Liberals before the end of the Second World War. And in the kind of one of those summary judgments that I think the British electorate are tremendously good at delivering, they voted Beveridge out in the 1945 election. He didn't actually return to see any of this get enacted. Why is this important? Well, a thoroughly socialist welfare state would pay for everything out of general taxation. That's the principle of a kind of socialist welfare state in a lot of senses. We only pay for some of what we have out of general taxation, at least in the 1940s, the NHS being the obvious one. But Beveridge, in his report, describes paying for things out of general taxation as the Santa Claus state. It's a government that dishes out presents to everybody and no one knows who's paid for them, is what he says. And that's why we have a system of national insurance. The idea is that people pay in and they get out based on what they've paid in. It's entitlement based on contribution, to use the phrase that Beveridge uses during that period. And this idea is really important. It's important in establishing the grounds for entitlement, the grounds for the broader support that there is for this system in the 1940s. And it's also the origin of Beveridge's phrase, which is where the title of the book comes from. Beveridge says that there's to be bread for all before cake for anybody. The idea is that everybody should be paying in, we ensure that everybody is at a certain level, and then people can take what they like above that. That's what it's supposed to be. I guess the point would be that there is supposed to be cake at the end of it. So the welfare state in this sense is supposed to be a platform for everybody to kind of realise the good life. It's supposed to be a basic minimum level of entitlement for everybody. So just to kind of wrap things up, I just have a couple of points that I think I'd like to make in terms of reflecting on what this all means now and where we stand with things. I mean, I touch on this in a bit in the conclusion to the book. The first is that I think that we've reached an unfortunate position where we have allowed the way that we talk about the welfare state to be narrowed in a way that's quite unhelpful for thinking about what it is that it does for us and does for our lives. We've allowed things to be effectively narrowed to talking about those who receive cash benefits, which in reality is only a very small amount of the overall welfare budget, and is also unhelpful in thinking about the ways that we're connected with it in that kind of Beveridgian way. The second, I think, is that it narrows our frame of reference, as it were, for thinking about the welfare state. It allows us to think that welfare is an act of charity rather than a genuine social system with things that we are all involved in paying for and could all at any point in time receive benefits from. And that's important because the welfare state should be at the centre of a kind of well-functioning economy. That's what it should be about. It should be about dealing with the problems that can't be solved in any other way. And it's important to think that the introduction of this system, the introduction of this way of doing things, it coincides with one of the longest periods of security, growth and productivity in this country. And, that isn't a coincidence. And lots of people have enjoyed good lives from the broader environment, the broader economy and the broader society that was built on this achievement. And so my final point, I think, is really to say that that doesn't mean that something that was created in the 1940s after 100 years, we need to somehow just recreate that in that form. The world is a different place. We confront different problems and we need to think about what those problems are and we need to think about how it is that we're going to go about solving them, of which questions like how is it that we're going to pay for things are obviously important. That's not an illegitimate conversation to have. There's certainly a sense in which maybe being a bit more Keynesian about the economy might be quite helpful in terms of thinking about jobs and employment. But we could also think about a range of other issues connected with payment. That idea of the contributory principle, there isn't a single way of organising that. We had a particular way of doing it in the 1940s, but other countries, including Germany, have a contributory principle that works slightly differently. Is there some way that that could be put back at the heart of the welfare system? But is there a sense in which, actually, more generally, we might think about changing the tax system to pay for some of the things that we want? I think, it's not necessarily the case that everybody supports every aspect of the welfare state, but everybody supports some aspect of it, NHS being the one institution that seems to have cross-party support. And we need to think about how is it that we pay for that? Do we need to change the tax system to include more things like wealth tax or property tax? And that would involve, in a lot of ways, returning to a kind of pre-poor law reform world, where at the beginning of the 19th century, most taxation was local and levied by local communities, not by central government. But they're just some kind of random thoughts to put out there. I'll wrap up there, and hopefully you'll have some questions. Thank you.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk. or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.